This is the world's big story, and the finance ministers were just in shock, almost in panic this weekend. There are riots all over the world right now in the poor countries over these soaring food prices.
And I know firsthand how awful a food riot can be. Last week, Whole Foods had a sale on starfruit. It was madhouse. I could barely make it to the bok choy. Now, some blame the food shortage on factors like overpopulation and climate change, although that climate change excuse may be a distraction by Al Gore, so we won't notice him eating everything. But others say our own government is adding to the shortage. Jim?
This corn to ethanol subsidy, which our government is doing, really makes little sense. We've been putting our food into the gas tank.
Ridiculous. Using corn to make fuel isn't causing a food shortage. If there's one thing we've done for our poor, it's to give them plenty of corn in the form of high fructose corn syrup. That is like getting a full serving of vegetables in every package of Starburst.
Hey, what's happening, everybody? What is going on? This is My Life as a Foodie. Man, this whole Democratic race is just becoming the story of the year, isn't it? Every day, there's something new to report. I just think it's great to watch. It's like a sporting event. Anyway, I don't want to talk politics here, but I just want to say this is definitely going to be a year to remember. And a lot of podcasts don't want to bring up politics. They don't want to talk about religion, politics, race issues, anything like that. It's just kind of it's stuff that you just want to avoid because if you bring it up, and some do, there's hell to pay for it. So we just try not to. But you have to admit, love them or hate them, the Democrats are making this thing really interesting. Anyway, I had a birthday recently, and my wife managed to surprise me with a gift that I've been eyeballing for a really, really long time. I now have a full photo studio with a couple of 200-watt cold head studio strobes, umbrellas, and stands. I've been a photographer off and on for about 25 years now, over 25 years. And the studio lighting has always kind of been a dream of mine to actually own. I've worked in many studios and did a lot of portable family photography where we would go to locations and do on-location shoots, but I never really owned that gear. And a lot of the gear, even though it was really good, I never really owned it. So my food pictures should really start to see improvement. Only reason I'm bringing this up. So whenever I make something here in studio and I'll shoot it, you're going to notice a big difference. And I'm really excited about that. You know, when you're a photographer, lighting is a really big thing. A videographer, it's a big thing. I mean, without lights, you know, you're shooting video. And without lights, you've got radio. And without lights, a photographer, you know, you basically have crayons, really. There's not much to it, so it's a big thing to have good lights, especially soft lighting like that. You'll see a difference in the stuff that I'm shooting that's not location stuff. Not sure if any of you follow the Brain Gravy podcast, but there is a new episode of that was released last week, episode 5 of Brain Gravy at braingravy.libsyn.com, or check beersafari.com and download it directly from there. It's Jungle of Beer. It's a very funny episode. Definitely not safe for work. I'm not even sure it's safe for home. Maybe in your car. On your iPod. Something. It's crazy. If you've never listened to it, Brain Gravy, it's like an audioscape. I liken it to an audioscape on acid. Because it sounds like you're on acid the entire time you're listening to it. They get on Tiki Chat, and they talk to each other, and it's really adult, and it's funny. And I met Mr. Whiskey recently, who started listening to the show a little bit, and he listened to the other podcast I was doing for a while, Dude Night, and now he's listening to this, and he chimed in. He does the artwork for Brain Gravy. So what's really kind of cool is that the artwork is just crazy, and it matches Brain Gravy just perfectly because it's cool. It's like it's an audio trip. So check it out, braingravy.libsyn.com. Libsyn, Libsyn.com. One of my favorite breweries in the U.S., Dogfish Head, from Delaware is finally available again here on the West Coast. They were being distributed by Stone Brewing for a while, and then Stone wasn't distributing them anymore. But now they're back in wide distribution through, I guess, Harbor Distributing here in Southern California. Anyway, I was able to pick up four packs of their 90-minute IPA, Midas Touch, and Palo Santo Moron. Sam Caglione he's like a mad scientist brewer. He brews radical stuff. I mean, all the beers that he brews have special flavors. It's not normal stuff. He doesn't brew like, you know, pale ale, stout, and a wheat beer. He doesn't do that. You know, he does really distinct flavors. He puts wood in their beer and raisins and pumpkin and all sorts of really weird stuff. And I'm not that brave. I mean, when I brew, I'm not even close. I mean, that's why you'll never see me screwing around with things like hazelnut porter or vanilla stouts or smoked beers anymore. I don't do that, any of that. I did for a while. I've tried it in the past. And I was always just not happy. The end result, I was not happy. I ended up having to choke down what I couldn't give away. And my friends were very nice about it. They were always nice, very complimentary. But I knew it was bad. And I just don't like it. I like when other people do it. Because then the pressure's not on me. I can drink a bottle of it. And if I don't like it, I don't like it. Anyway, speaking of beer, tonight we're having Alesmith's Horny Devil, which is a Belgian strong ale. Alesmith Brewing Company is located right here in San Diego, a couple hours south of me, and they produce a lot of really great beers year-round. This particular beer, the Horny Devil, is an authentic Belgian strong ale, which includes classic Belgian ingredients like Belgian candy sugar and coriander. A coriander is, as you know, you may or may not know, is the seed of cilantro. Now, you've tasted cilantro, but the coriander seed actually has a different flavor. It's like a citrus flavor, almost like an orange citrus flavor. So it gives beer a nice citrus characteristic. So this is a Belgian strong ale, and that word strong can only really mean one thing, alcohol, 11%. Enough talk, let's drink. I'm going to pour here. Now it's nice golden color here, a little cloudy. Interesting, there's carbonation in the beer, but the head just gone. Smells citrusy. Let's taste this. It's a little sweet. You know, interesting, though. Hold on. It's sweet, but like when you first put it in your mouth, it tastes sweet, but then the coriander kind of has a sour tang to it, which is natural for coriander. It seems to balance the sweetness of the beer out. It's nice. It's very nice beer. It's very smooth. Now, the bottle was about $12, and it's 750 milliliters, so 3/4 of a liter. Now, I'd ordinarily, a beer this size, I would like to share it with somebody, but I'm all alone here tonight, so it's just me, and I'm just going to have to do the job myself. But like I've said before, Sam Caglione, Dogfish Head, he said it best. He said, you know, you say you might... $12 might be a little steep for a beer, even though, you know, you're getting as much as you're getting here. But when you stop to think that you can taste the world's best beers for anywhere between 10 and 20 bucks a bottle, then turn around, try to taste the world's best wines. You're going to pay about 5 to 10 times that amount. So if you put it into perspective like that, it's a pretty good deal. It's really a sweet deal. You know, if you hadn't told me this beer was highly alcoholic, I couldn't tell you myself, because... It says right here on the bottle 11% ABV, but it's drinking like 7, which could be dangerous. So I better pace myself and get myself in trouble. Okay, so Thai Basil is a restaurant here in Fullerton, and they serve authentic Thai food, very fresh, and they make it authentically Thai. Thai cuisine is known for a balance of 5 fundamental flavors that are included in each dish or just the overall meal. So throughout your meal, whether it's in, you know, every dish or throughout the meal, you'll taste 5 separate flavors: spicy, sour, sweet, salty, and bitter. And the cuisines of Thailand are kind of separated by region too. So there's southern curries, for example, would kind of, you know, they tend to contain coconut milk and turmeric. And then northeastern dishes would include things like lime juice. So Thai food's kind of known for its use of fresh herbs and spices, definitely not dried. Everything's fresh. As well as fish sauce, which is kind of a big thing there, too. And it's funny because two of the featured ingredients in the meal that we had, the meal that I'm going to tell you about, the ingredients that stood out the most were eggplant and basil. Now, when I say eggplant and basil, immediately, what do you think of? Tell me. What style of cuisine immediately pops into your head? Eggplant and basil. What? What? I can't hear you. That's right, Italian. Italians are known for many things, but when I say eggplant and basil, you're immediately going to think of eggplant parmesan or some other Italian dish. And as I've said before, high cuisine, good cooking, all the real good stuff, it all came from Asia. That's where food started. It was leavened bread, fish, and water before the Asian influence got everywhere else, and people started playing with ingredients. And that's why I will continue to go to the Asian well more often than any other type of cuisine on this show, because I respect it, I love the Asian people for it, I feel connected to it. I thank them every day for showing us all how to cook and how to enjoy food. And this stuff is especially fresh, so it's not just, you know, your run-of-the-mill saucy stuff. It's very good. It's very fresh. And this restaurant was just brilliant. And we love our friends who took us there. They're like parents to us. So whenever we get together, it always feels like family. And the restaurant is called Thai Basil, and it's located here in Fullerton. We ordered appetizers first. So the first thing you do, you sit down, you order appetizers. We ordered chicken. There's tons of things you can order. But we ordered chicken satay, which was grilled chicken that was sliced into spears, and then it's on wooden skewers, and it's served with cucumber salad and a peanut sauce. So you can dip them in the peanut sauce and have the cucumber salad with it. And then we ordered spring rolls, which are steamed rice wrappers that you stuff with bean noodles and vegetables, basil, and then they serve that with a plum sauce. Now, they wanted to order beer, but I'm not really a big fan of Asian beers at all, really. Now, Asian beer just doesn't do it for me. So they had Tsinghao or something. I can't even remember what they drank. Signu, something like that, some Chinese beer. Shangha. I have pictures on the website of the beer. If you want to check it out on the website, usually I'll just drink water and tea. That's it. If I'm going to have a beer, it's going to be a good one. And no offense, but I just don't like Asian beers very much. So there's that. So anyway, so you have the appetizers and you drink your beers and now you talk. And then before you know it, the food's here again. And they bring out this big-ass bowl of steamed rice. It goes right in the middle of the table. And then they bring out the dishes and it's all served family style. And family style is you'll serve, like say you have four people. So you might order three or four different entrees, and then you can all pull from the entrees and just kind of make your own plate. So we ordered this thing called green sea, which was a combination of seafood and a green curry with coconut milk, sweet basil, red and green bell peppers. And then we had pad thai, which is a classic. Rice noodles that are pan-fried with... did I say fried? Rice noodles pan-fried with fish sauce, sugar, lime juice, tamarind, chopped peanuts, and I think egg or something, and then they had tofu in there too. And to me, pad thai was hands down the best dish on the table, rivaled only by an eggplant dish we had too. Beef penang is another classic Thai dish. We had that spicy curry with beef, included some roasted spices, had a really good kick. I mean, an extra kick. And then pad pak rum. I'm sure I'm slaughtering the pronunciation of that. That was a stir-fried eggplant that was served in a really rich sauce with tons of Thai basil in it, on it, everywhere. And like I said, vying for the best dish on the table between that and the pad thai, my two favorites. So, you know, at that point, you finish dinner and you got all the rice and you're done. I mean, you're done, especially if you're drinking beer. Beer and rice together, that will fill your belly like nobody's business. We did find a little bit of room for some coconut ice cream, which was great. It was like an ice milk. And it actually had real chunks of coconut in it. And it was just delicious. But the best part about it is that you're eating family style. And family style is kind of an Asian custom. You share, you know. You have what you like. You don't have what you don't. You eat as much or as little as you like. You talk. You're moving around the table. The food's going crazy. You know, the table's a food highway. You know, you got dishes going left and right. There's chopsticks flying everywhere. You're communicating at the table. You're talking. You know, I know that's bizarre for Americans, but we should talk at the table. But it's a wonderful thing. And another thing I love about Asian culture, the family atmosphere and sharing and just getting involved with your food. Oh, this beer is good, man. Tastes Belgian. I just have this thing with Belgian beers. Y'all know me by now. Belgian beers are definitely my favorite. Damnation, Duvel. This one's great. I don't know what it is. You know, I got my first exposure to Belgian beer was Chimay, which, you know, to this day remains, you know, one of my all-time favorites. My friend Darren turned me on to it. One night we were at this restaurant, and he ordered a bottle of this, and we had it, and I'd never tasted anything like it, and it just changed everything. It changed my entire outlook on beer. And then when I brew it, I just feel like I'm cheating when I'm actually making beer that's Belgian, because you're not supposed to be able to do that. I still feel weird about that. Stan Hieronymus wrote a book called How to Brew Like a Monk. Changed my life, because it didn't have any recipes in it. It just talked about how, you know, it talked about the history of you know, the monks making beer, but then it talked about what went into making the beer. So it's like here's a Belgian strong ale. It has this, 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 and this in it. Go make one. You know, put as much of this in it as you want. Put as little of this in it as you want. Do your thing. It was total artistry. And that art aspect stuck with me. You know, I talked about it on Big Foamy Head once. It's true. It just stuck with me. It just kind of broadened my outlook on beer, because these people are artists, so they're doing their thing. I mean, this was made up. This is just God's gift to us right now, really. Anyway, I haven't really spoken much about season 4 of Top Chef. And that was only because I was kind of underwhelmed with the season's lineup of cooks. And I really talked it up. And then season 4 started, and I was just kind of let down because everyone just seemed kind of weird and mean, and I just wasn't getting into it. But I'm watching it because it's my show. But recently, it started to pick up, and I'm seeing some chefs that can really cook. Richard, Stephanie, Dale, Lisa, Andrew. I mean, this might be the best batch of cooks that they've seen on this show, period. I mean, there's always been a high level of chefs on the shows. And some seasons have had more than others, but there are chefs on this season's show that I think could actually rival those chefs that are actually Michelin quality chefs. But that being said, one of the things that really irritated me in the first couple of episodes was the swearing. And not that I'm against swearing, because, you know, I've said it before, I'm not against that because I do it. It's the beeping. I can't stand the goddamn beeping. I know it's on cable. Bravo depends on advertising, so they can't really allow cursing. But if you're going to bleep it, maybe it would be a better idea just to edit it out entirely. Because let's face it, I've said in the past, chefs have potty mouths. They curse, they smoke, they drink, they're promiscuous, they fuck in the freezer, they do drugs. They're epitome of metal, as Brother Chud would say, metal. He would say fucking metal. But these food TV stars you see, like Paula Deen, Rachel Ray, Sandra Lee, the Big Fat Contessa, they're giving you the wrong idea. That's not what we're talking about here, all right? This is the real deal. These are raw cooks. These are raw chefs. They're not just in your face. They're up your ass. So I put together a montage, 60 minutes of Top Chef, condensed into like a minute. And I didn't really have to search much to get this, all right? I just hit play, and I recorded every time somebody said something offensive or something that got bleeped. Listen.
I have a culinary boner right now.
I woke up this morning and I was like, everybody.
How the am I going to buy a dinner for four with $10? That's impossible. Impossible.
Hey, no way.
Sweetheart.
No
you
way.
Were just putting your teammate in the ground.
So what?
Yeah, so f***ing what?
That's weak.
All right, we get your f***ing point. You're just making it worse.
That was not the person.
Bullshit. So by saying it over and over again is going
to
make
yeah,
it better.
You get to bitch and whine about everything you f***ing feel about. I don't say sh**. The 1 minute I say sh** about something, you gonna talk sh**? That's bull sh**.
Next on Top Chef.
The constant negativity, it's starting to wear on some people in the house.
Dale can go f*** himself as far as I'm concerned. Doing this for Zoe. The fact that Spike is still here and she's not, that's just total bull.
Kind of annoying, right? Funny, no doubt, but the bleeping is just horrible. It gets in the way of the show for me. I say let them either curse, because, you know, you'd have to be an idiot not to figure out that she just said Dale can go fuck himself. Or just don't put it in. Maybe if she said Dale can go fuck himself, have her say it again. Dale can go screw himself, or Dale can go F himself. You have to be creative here, because the bleeping is really fucking annoying to my fucking ears. And I can't even watch this fucking piece of fuck on a Wednesday night, you know? F*** me in the f***. Top Chef Wednesday nights on Bravo. Like everyone, just about, I love pizza. And my favorite style of pizza is New York style. The latest issue of Wired magazine has an interesting take on why New York pizza can't really be duplicated outside of New York, especially here in California. And you want to know what they think it is? The water. Mario Batali said water is huge. It's probably one of California's biggest problems with pizza. Chris Loss is a food scientist with the Culinary Institute of America. He said that water binds the dough's few ingredients and that nearly every chemical reaction that produces flavor occurs in water. So naturally, the minerals and chemicals in it will affect every aspect of the way something tastes. Even Mario encounters the water problem in his New York restaurant, Del Posto, where he makes traditional Italian food. The tap water in Manhattan is a lot different from the water in Italy. His solution was to create his own mineral water composite. Working from a chemical analysis of La Acqua Italiana, which is the water of Italy, I guess, Batali's team basically clones the H2O that gives the food in Italy its form. Mario opened a pizzeria here in L.A. It's called Pizzeria Mozza. And I've been wanting to go there. We meant to go there last year. So maybe this summer I'll make a trek up there and we'll record there and see what the pizza's like. And I've had New York-style pizza in New York. And it really is fantastic. I think that's when I got hooked on it. But I really haven't had enough of that to say I could taste the difference between, you know, what I've gotten in New York and what I've tasted here in places like Russian River Brewery, where they have excellent New York-style pizzas there. Or CPK, California Pizza Kitchen. They make pretty good thin-crust New York-style pies. But I know that's not going to rival New York pizza, but it's pretty cool. You know, people think it's they're not sure what it is, so they're blaming it on the water, and they don't really believe it. But, you know, water has a lot to do with brewing beer. And I treat every drop of water that I use when I'm brewing. And I add salts and minerals. I create my own water profile. And that's my secret, just like any other brewery. We don't share that stuff with anybody. But if you want to taste it, you can come down to Clarkhead Brewery. You can have all you like. Really, I've noticed a difference, even in pizza dough and bread dough when I make bread or pizza. If I use standard tap water versus purified bottled water, or even water that I've run through a charcoal filter, you know, there's a big difference there. And it's been kind of dramatic in some cases. So there is something to be said for the water theory. Horny devil. The whole devil thing with Belgian beer is kind of strange, too, because they're Catholics, the monks Catholics. So they brought in the whole Satan aspect, I guess, to kind of acknowledge it. I don't remember the theory on that. Maybe someone can chime in. Offhand, I can't remember. I did know, but I've obviously had a lot to drink. So, horny devil. Obviously meaning horny, or as in because it's got horns. Or maybe the other thing. I don't know. Jelly Belly Candy Company. I wanted to talk about this. It's one of the most interesting places I'd ever visited. I went there a couple of years ago with my wife. We were going to wine country in Sonoma, and it was on our way. So we went in. We actually made it a stop for us. It was a really interesting tour. Got to see how they made the jelly beans, and I tasted a lot of really cool jelly beans. You know, they do really weird stuff sometimes. They did like jalapeno and some really other weird flavors. But I mean, recently I read something. They crossed the line. I mean, they really crossed the line. It takes a lot to actually irritate me, and this irritated me. They developed a new product called Bean Boozled. It contains two sets of identically colored jelly beans. All right, you get one that's a traditional jelly bean, and then another one that is super freaking nasty. And you don't know which one you're eating. So you get a blue one. It could be berry blue or toothpaste. Now, that's not that bad. A purple one could be plum or black pepper. That's not really that bad. Pepper's nice. Then they get really mean. They get brutally mean. Grab a black one. It could be licorice, which is kind of nice. Or skunk spray, which is not nice at all. Or another one that could be a banana or pencil shavings. How about a choice between buttered popcorn or a rotten egg? A rotten egg. Smells like farts. Imagine eating that. Cafe latte or earwax. Juicy pear or a booger. Coconut or a baby wipe. Peach or vomit. Should I continue? Vomit? Are you kidding me? Vomit? I can't believe they're even marketing this crap. Seriously, Jelly Belly can go screw themselves with this idea. I really hope it bankrupts them. I'm serious. I mean, if you're going to experiment with duplicating nice flavors, maybe make a set of beans that duplicate vegetables or peppers or distinct tastes like béarnaise sauce, chili cheese dip, or a smoked sausage. I mean, if you want to be weird, do like durian fruit or something. But not vomit and baby shit and rotten eggs. That's just messed up. Nobody should buy this. And whoever approved the idea needs to be fired. Seriously. This is stupid. Beanie butts. Anyway, I have to settle down. This beer is making me angry. I found this report from CNN. It covered a cooperative between several families in the parish of Martin in England. And this is really cool. I mean, I really fell in love with this story. These people, they all have a hand in this large piece of land where they raise animals and they grow vegetables. And they eat what they grow. It's an 8-acre farm. And they're kind of sustained by the farm. So they live off of it. And then they sell the rest of what they don't eat at the local markets, which kind of puts the funds back into the farm. It's beautiful. They're called Future Farms. Listen to this.
It's a quiet revolution in the village of Martin, and nearly everyone is involved.
You just can't get anything this fresh, you know, from the supermarket.
And to know exactly where it's all coming from and see it growing.
In back gardens and rented fields, they're growing more than 40 types of fruit and veg, rearing 30 pigs a year and 110 chickens a month.
Yes, it's an oversized allotment, you know. And I've always been growing things all my life.
They're proud of their achievement.
When you get a sense of the whole village working together at these sort of great moments when we do all sort of picking and planting and that kind of thing, it's great because we all do pull together and it's a wonderful sense of community.
Future Farms was the idea of this man.
We have 102 members, that's family members, so that's probably 400 people who are members. That means that they co-own the cooperative. They pay a small fee each year of £2.
What you see here is all part of the cooperative in the village. It covers two main sites. Now that in total is round about 8 acres. And it's farmed, importantly, by the villagers themselves. So they do all of that work on a rota basis. They just get in some seasonal hired help.
We have rotas for, you know, doing the weighing of the chickens for Saturday morning market, shutting up the chickens. And that way we're able to use people when they have time available.
That includes artists, medics and retired farmers. Their nearest supermarket is 6 miles away, but they don't use that much. They sell at the village market once a week, adding 20% to the production price. Anyone can buy. All profits go back into the company. They've got a turnover of $54,000 a year. And the aim?
The limit of our market is the 164 families that live within the parish of Martin.
Forget big profits and going global. This is about feeding themselves and getting other villages doing the same.
That is the future, man. I mean, these aren't just foodies. They're conscientious foodies. I applaud you. I applaud them for being this smart, this forward in their thinking. I mean, people who do this are really in touch with the situation that we're faced with, and they're set to have really rich lives. And when I say rich, I don't mean like, you know, money rich. Because we all know farmers don't make a lot of money. But they're rich inside. When you're rich inside, man, that's where it counts. You're rich. You're really rich. I mean, you're deep. It goes deep. So I applaud you. I applaud them. I applaud anybody who grows gardens, no matter how small they are. Talked about this earlier with Kirk, who grows Victory Garden. It's a big thing in England. That's where the Victory Garden started. So grow some food. I applaud anybody who grows a garden, no matter how small it is. Just grow a little bit of it. You watch how it affects you, how it changes your table and changes your life, and it alleviates some pressure off the environment. I mean, bravo. Oh, Paula Deen. Oh, this is great.
Hey, y'all.
Yeah, hey, y'all. I just read this article this morning, and I just had to share it with you. She's finally going to get a little love tap in the bad place, if you know what I'm talking about. This article comes courtesy of Michael Park at Epicurious.com. Thank you, Michael. She may look like a kindly southern grandmother who's not above swigging from the cooking sherry and hooping it up with the grandkids out on the porch, but Paula Deen is being branded a sweatshop queen by the likes of Al Sharpton, Jesse Jackson, Susan Sarandon, and Danny Glover. The celebrity non-chefs will be joining protesters at a May 3rd Atlanta event that the Food Network star is headlining at the Cobb Galleria Center and will ask Deen to honor a promise that they say she made to meet with workers from a pork processing plant in Tar Heel, North Carolina. The plant's owned by the food company Smithfield, whose brand Deen promotes heavily. According to the protesters, Smithfield workers have to meet unreasonable speed quotas, don't get enough training, and endure threats, abuse, and crippling injuries. They say that the injuries at the Tar Heel plant went up 200% between 2003 and 2006. Dean, they note, told Larry King that she'd meet with the Smithfield workers. Oh, and looky here, I happen to have the audio for that.
Should have responded to this, I want to get it right. That you've gotten some flack for your endorsement deal. You have an endorsement deal with Smithfield Foods, a very famous company.
Yes.
The union that's trying to organize its North Carolina plant says the company's got a record of anti-worker activity, safety problems. Union supporters have asked you to meet with the workers and end your ties with Smithfield. Former Senator John Edwards, actor Danny Glover are among the big names who have called for increased safety measures at Smithfield. Why don't you meet with them?
Well, I'd be happy to, but I've been to the plant. I've met with workers with no one around but me and the workers. It's a beautiful company. And safety is a big issue
there.
They
won't let them unionize?
Oh, yes, yes. Yes, the employees actually voted.
To unionize?
Not to union.
So why do they still want to? So what's the big deal in meeting with them?
I don't know.
You would meet with them?
Oh, yes, absolutely I would. Smithfield is a good company. It's a good company. And these people are so happy to have their jobs. Good benefits, and you know they're happy.
Okay, you will meet with them if they want to meet.
Absolutely,
because I'd like to set up the meeting. We'll do it right here.
Okay.
They don't want to unionize. They like being treated like slaves.
Sure. These protests will take place presumably outside the Cobb Galleria Center, which is hosting the Metropolitan Cooking and Entertaining Show. Dean and her two closet homosexual sons will hold their cooking class at 3 p.m. on Saturday in the Viking Celebrity Cooking Theater. Now, I'm recording this on Friday, so I'm not sure what the outcome of this is, but you would know by the time the show is posted. In any event, I'm happy to finally see that woman get some bad press, all right? I've been holding this down for a while, so I'm about to blow up. I think she's a phony. I always have thought she was a phony. And I know she comes off as a nice person, but I don't buy her bullshit persona. And she cooks food like she's trying to kill you. I mean, I read a recipe of hers not too long ago. It was like a cheeseburger with an egg on it, and then it was served with a Krispy Kreme donut instead of a hamburger bun. I mean, are you kidding me? Consult your cardiologist before you buy any of her cookbooks, or just do yourself a favor and don't watch. Cooking at home is a wonderful thing, but if you're going to cook like this, you'd be better off just eating a pound of lard for dinner. Food TV is off its noggin, to coin a phrase. But this is what's wrong with it. They've got jackoffs like her as hosts. She's got a ton of recipes like this. I mean, deep-fried butter, deep-fried bacon-wrapped mac and cheese, calls for like a pound of bacon and five eggs. Dudes, I mean, come on, please, bacon. Anytime I see bacon in a recipe, I immediately think that this was a recipe that sucked, so they needed something to make it right. So they add bacon. And seriously, think about it. I've given this a lot of thought. It's true. Bacon is a home run flavor in almost any dish it's in. Almost. I mean, imagine a lettuce and tomato sandwich. Meh. But bacon, lettuce, and tomato sandwich. Oh, come on. That's a home run. It's on a menu. Cheeseburger. It's good. I'll eat it. Bacon cheeseburger. Now you're talking. And I'll have two of those. I mean, even bacon bits were invented for people who were bored with a salad. It's a salad. Add some bacon bits, and holy shit, that's an entree. I mean, I used to know some guys that were so hooked on bacon that they kept a jar of bacon bits in their desk. You know, you just buy a bar of bacon bits, and they'd keep it in their desk, and they'd get this craving middle of the afternoon, like a crack addict. Out came this jar of bacon bits, and they'd have a little handful of it, and they'd slam it down. And you remember in the mid-90s, they had all these fad diets, like the cabbage soup diet, where you like make this big bowl of cabbage soup. You'd make a whole pot of it, and then you'd have a bowl of it a day. That kind of, they had a bunch of those diets. And one of the hot tickets was the baked potato diet. People would order a plain baked potato, and that's what they'd have for lunch or dinner. And then sometimes, if it was dinner, they'd have sliced turkey with it, but that was it. No butter, sour cream, nothing on it. Maybe a little salt. But before you knew it, people started adding bacon bits. And then it became a massive hit. Baked potatoes were like the rage. And then you saw these massive baked potatoes with all the stuff on it. Cheese, butter, cream, bacon, chili, whatever. I mean, it went from something that maybe had like 200 calories to an artery clogging, big massive mess, 1200 calorie thing. About 30 or 50 grams of fat. Just disgusting. But that type of cooking, that's where this is going. This woman, Carol, she does this food blog called The French Laundry at Home. She cooks meals from the French Laundry cookbook, and then she'll post pictures and step-by-step instructions on her blog. She did this April Fool's joke where she used processed and canned ingredients to attempt a French Laundry dish. It looked really unhealthy, just awful. It even had these canned Vienna sausages on the plate. Just wretched. By the time you got to like the end, she told you she was screwing with you. But the best part was that the recipe for these chicken stack-ups and the fruit nectar salad were actually adapted from a book, Better Homes and Gardens Make Ahead Cookbook, which was published in 1971. It was a book of recipes prepared and served by people who were allegedly loved their families. Somehow I doubt it. But that's what these food TV cooks, not chefs, are doing now. I mean, they're making dishes in the kitchen to make you think you're cooking healthy for your family, but they're slowly giving your family heart disease and turning your asses into huge couch pillows. Yeah, I gotta go. Obviously, the horny devil's making me grouchy. I probably said some unkind things here, too, and I'm not editing a damn thing out. I'll blame it on Ailsmith. Damn you, Ailsmith!
I drink your milkshake!
Yes, I do. And it was good. It's a good milkshake. Hey, if you want to try something new, you've never had Thai food, don't be afraid of it, all right? It's fresh. It's good. You will not be disappointed. It's none of those strange flavors. It's just brilliant. Thanks to the folks over at Thai Basil Restaurant in Fullerton. Awesome meal. Thanks again to you for listening. My name is Phil. This has been My Life as a Foodie. I will see you on the other side. Later.
A culinary boner right now.